place to be necessarily, because Ortiz is going to go forward and establish position anyway, and he is putting the blinkers on, so it might as well, you know, might as well be right in the spot that is the shortest way around, as they say. We could talk. We'll talk to Tony later about a couple of topics, and that the one hole wouldn't be a bad topic to spin with Tony. The rest of the field, and of course, Improbable and Omaha Beach vying for favoritism, and Omaha Beach draws the three. In between them, Paul Holtis with the trap shot six shooter, the two hole with Davey Cohen, and then Omaha Beach and Richard Mandela on hand here. And it was funny because Richard, I was sitting here and doing some post-production work, and Richard came around the looking around said, "Richard, what are you looking for?" He said, where's the draw? I said, back the other way, and sent him over. And so really a good spot for Omaha Beach, and the decisions are going to be made early, how Mike Smith and Jose Ortiz choose to, you know, choose to look at each other and decide who might be allowed to set the pace. And there is certainly Gray attempt out there. He ended up drawing the six, and Gray attempt a big part of this because he's been on the lead every single time except for his first start. And Gray attempt, you can certainly expect to be forward as well. Galilean, who drew the seven, Galilean takes the blinkers off. And so even though he has generally been on or near, you got to think that taking blinkers off might relax Galilean a bit. And he had the most recent six furlong work at Los Al, 114. So Hollendorfer has been trying to get him to relate and relax. And so Galilean stalks outside. One flew south, Doug O'Neill, the other West Coast invader, coming out of that Mind That Bird Derby, and last seen there in February. He puts blinkers on, and he is generally, in his two starts, has been at least, you know, in the vanguard, as Tom Durkin would say. So you look at where the speed might come from, and it's spread out, and it'll be very interesting to see what tactic Ortiz, how forward he wants to be. And I mean, I don't think he wants to necessarily tackle Gray attempt immediately, you know, into the turn. But I think he'll be forward, establish position, and then, you know, let it spin from there to run him down, because long-range Toddy, he, in some ways, I don't know, I won't say compromised, but he ends up in the 11 hole on the outside, and he, you know, he's got a stalking style. And so John Court is going to have to move at least a little bit early down the stretch the first time, and, you know, find a comfortable spot. So he may find himself a little further back, you know, depending on where Court can, you know, slide in before the turn. So we'll see how that plays out. And he did draw, you know, all you have to do is go back to the Southwest experience, when Richard Aramia had him. And in the Southwest, you know, he was third behind Supersteed and Sueno, and you know, that he was 10th in the 10 hole there of 11. And, you know, he established position, was really never that far away, even though he was, you know, he was outposted. So we'll see how John Court handles it. So running him down, Improbable, six shooter, Omaha Beach, Tikvin Flew, Steve Asmussen and the Bloom Racing team, and Saul Kuhlman with Matticat. Tikvin Flew, who seemingly, this is a two-turn debut, and we'll see. It's hard to know, you know, what to expect. Street Sense, you know, out of a deputy minister mayor, and, you know, most recently, sixth in the Gotham. Laughing Fox for the Lieblongs, and Steve Asmussen. And, of course, Laughing Fox tried the Rebel, the division with Omaha Beach, and that came after a nice allowance win. Santana sticks, Gray attempt, as we mentioned, the 6. Galilean, the 7, with Flavian Pratt making the trip here. Country House for Bill Mott and Jerry Shields and partners. They're looking at Lucky Colt coming out of the 4th in the Louisiana Derby. Before that, 2nd in the Risen Star. And so it won't take much for Country House to firm up his Derby point position. Jersey agenda for Mr. Fipke and the Jerseytown Colt. Steve Asmussen, of course, and Ramon Vasquez, also coming out of the Omaha Beach Rebel, where he was 5th, and actually, you know, despite some traffic, ran a credible 5th in there, and might be one of the outsiders with some upside. You know, certainly early in the winter when he won that allowance race and, you know, came back in that first start as a 3-year-old, then it didn't run the race that was anticipated from him in the Southwest. And so Jersey Agenda, kind of one of those post-hype classic trail 3-year-olds. Long Range Toddy, as mentioned, and John Court in the 11 hole. So 11 of them line up in the Grade 1, the $1 million Arkansas Derby. And, you know, the day itself is a little bit different than, you know, we've gotten used to. We've gotten so accustomed to the big monster stake days, and with the later finish to the meet this year, the first year of this expanded calendar or shifted calendar, it's not as stake intense of a day. There's lots of good allowance races. And there's some other really notable horses on the card. And when you dive in, if you haven't had a chance to go through it yet, there's plenty to look forward to, including a maiden try in the Nightcap by Cowboy Diplomacy. Of course, the Monomoy Girl sibling, the Tapazar colt. You also, earlier in the card, the other two stakes, actually, the Count Fleet, of course, and that seems to boil down to Whitmore and Mitol. And Mitol, coming back in this spot, really seems to have a pace edge on Whitmore. We may see Ron Moquette later this morning. Ron said he might stop by, and I'd have to think that Whitmore is a little compromised here. There's just nobody to run with Mitol. The rest of the field is Bourbon Cowboy, Storm Advisory, who does put on blinkers, and Operation Stevie for Cipriano Contreras, coming off a win, too, and a money allowance. So I don't know. I don't know how Mitol, who's going to leave from the one hole, I don't see how anybody is going to get to him. But if there is somebody that's eligible, it's Whitmore. And Moquette has certainly enabled, you know, come into spots like that where Whitmore might have to be ridden a little more aggressively. The 6th race on Saturday, you've got a not a big field, but a couple of notable horses that lined up for this 6-furlong first level allowance. Roatan shows up in here. The Larry Best Hollendorfer Into Mischief that was last seen in the American Pharaoh behind Game Winner and Gunmetal Gray, his stablemate. And before that, he had split Game Winner and Roadster in the Del Mar Futurity. So Roatan, who a little delayed getting his 3-year-old season started, but he turns up in here in a $101,000 purse, a stake purse for a first level allowance. Lots of interesting names in here as you look at this card. And how about Danny Pites with the $700,000 Bodemeister that's going to debut in the 7th for Shadwell, Sur Rouge. Nice to see Danny Pites with a pricey horse like that from Sheikh Hamdan. You've got the Oaklawn Handicap, of course, the Grade 2, and it ended up with a field that that isn't exactly star laden, but it has a lot of a lot of quality, familiar steak types. And Steve Asmussen, over these couple of days, virtually every four-year-old from last year's classic trail has turned up in the entries, including Tenfold, who drew the rail and adds blinkers in here. Tenfold, one of my personal favorites from last year. And with everything that went on in that Triple Crown run, the horse that could have been the interruption that could have been the fly in the ointment was Tenfold in that Preakness. And that's the most dirtied up third in a classic that you might ever see. And of course, you couldn't see it because of the fog. But Tenfold, with a little different trip, would have been the upsetter during the Triple Crown run. It came back, won the Jim Dandy, and then really didn't fire in the Travers. Came back in March to start his season, and was fourth in an allowance, money allowance at Fairgrounds. So Tenfold, off of that prep, comes in here, and he'll certainly be one of the considerations. But it's an eclectic group. Brad Cox sends Pioneer Spirit for Steve Landers. Chris and Dave, Villafranco and Danny Caldwell, who, of course, tear up the turf here. Not that there's turf to tear, but you get my drift. Looking at Lee, another of those classic trail types from Steve Asmussen. Of course, he's 5 years old now, and he started his season with a near miss behind Remembering Rita, Doug Anderson's nice five-year-old. He's in here as well. So looking to leave Remembering Rita. Peter Urton comes back to Oaklawn, and of course, he was third in the Essex, beaten less than a length by Rated R Superstar, the New York bred that we've certainly followed. And Quip, how about Quip? Rudy Brissett and Jose Ortiz, they're coming off the Hal's Hope, his seasonal debut as a four-year-old lone sailor for Tom Amos, and also now into, what, third start of the season, the Mineshaft, and then he was a little better in the New Orleans Handicap, beaten just a length and change by Core Beliefs, who ran that terrific race for Peter, and then Rated R Superstar off the Essex, trying to parlay the Essex prep into Oaklawn Handicap success. And Cipriano Contreras with Rated R Superstar, who had come here quite a bit with McPeak, too. He's got a nice record. 8 starts at Oaklawn, 2 wins, 3 seconds, and a third. So he's run well here. And, you know, one of the things everybody's going to have to do is, we're speculating, of course, is watching for the wet conditions, and be sure to, as you're handicapping, you know, make your notes and circle those wet track results. Chris and Dave, for instance, is 4 for 6 on a wet track. How about that? The 6-year-old, 1 for 9 here with 6 other board hits. So you got to do a lot of that. Anyway, it's a terrific card, and it's not what we've gotten so used to, which is, 6 or 7 stakes on the big Saturday. It's 3 nice stakes and a grade one and 2 grade twos, and then a lot of good allowance races. And even looking at the 10th after the Oaklawn Handicap, and as I told you, Steve Asmussen emptying the barn with those 4-year-olds and with those classic horses, because both Combatant and Zing Zang, they're both in here, which is great. So the Combatant, another one of those Asmussen horses that we took a shine to last year during the campaign. So Oaklawn, we're pretty much set for a big day, other than the weather portion, other than that frustration. Should be terrific. Looking over at Keeneland, let's get a quick handle on the Lexington. Just 20 points for the winner, 8, 4, and 2 for the rest of the superfecta, and it's a crowded group. 10 ended up showing up, and the ones that are you know, pretty much in need. Soueno, Harvey Wallbanger, another twist of fate. But kind of interesting that Ben Colbert, he's still trying with Knicks Go, K Knicks Go. He's not. They're not just going to go gently into the rest of the season. They're going to take one more try here. And another horse that bubbled up on the surface as the winter unfolded, Owendale, who looked for a minute like he was going to be a player, and then disappointed in the stake try. Owendale turns up in here. How about Victor Barboza with Zenden? Zenden in here. And Roland for Amos as well. But the big three that need the points to get in, Soueno, another twist of fate, and Harvey Wallbanger. You look at the point list, and even being second, like another twist of fate, it would be that much better positioned should a couple of horses not make the Derby. And of course, you're 3+ weeks out, and there's always the potential for somebody to for something to go awry. So we'll keep tabs. The rest of that field, Steve Asmussen with Shang for the Hiling Brats, Hawaiian Noises, Wesley Ward, Soueno, another twist of fate, Harvey Wallbanger, Chase the Ghost, Dallas Stewart and Miguel Mena, K-Knicks Go, Owendale, Zenden, Roland. So a field of 10 for the Lexington. And, of course, they're going to run the Ben Ally. They're going to give you the Jenny Wiley, where Chad Brown figures very prominent. Rushing fall in this spot. And on the moon again, Drew outside. He's also got Rimska. So the three-pronged Chad Brown attack on the Jenny Wiley, the grade one. But keep an eye on, there's a couple here to good year for Roses, and shows up as well. Beleve for now with in the Pletcher Barn, of course. So there's a nice group for the Jenny Wiley. And then there's, what's the other stake? There's one more stake beside the Ben Ally, the Jenny Wiley, the Lexington, and I'm pretty sure there's a four. I thought there was four. All right. Well, the cross country as well, the cross country pick four, will start in New York with the Top Flight. Then they come back with the Lexington and the Wiley. And then here, the Oaklawn Handicap and the Arkansas Derby. So a really nice all stakes. I can't call it all graded because the Top Flight is an invitational. So it's not graded. But the rest of that sequence, terrific stakes sequence. So the weekend is set for the most part. I'm going to bear with me a second because I am positive. And I'm going to turn to Keeneland because yesterday, I got to mention to you, Casey back in the hospital overnight, and Joanne helping on the board today, and I appreciate it. And somehow, Case, I don't even know how he got. Now I don't even know how he did it. But overnight, he sent me the message at 2:45. He got the archive and the podcast loaded from the hospital. So you want to talk about going above and beyond? Appreciate Casey getting that done. I know people were looking for it, and I tried to explain what was up. So bear with us on that, on those technical ends, if you could. Turning to Keeneland, yesterday, and I watched a little bit of the day, and I caught a couple of different spots, including two horses that are kind of favorites. Dynatale, how about Mike Denny and the now 5-year-old Dynatale gets away at almost 8-1. And Dynatale, prominent throughout with Luis Saez, who has not taken that momentum from Gulfstream, and it hasn't parlayed so far at Keeneland into tremendous success. He came into the day two for 25. But Dynatale, you know, who was really had a terrific couple of years at 3-4, and Dynatale returns as a 5-year-old, and she wins, and she wins well, and rewards backers to the tune of $1,760. So I was kind of tickled that Dynatale comes back running and wins for Denny. And if you were watching for the 2-year-olds, John Hancock, what a job Hancock does. And Alec and Arthur wins the opener, the 2-year-old race on the day. I think they're running almost one a day with the 2-year-olds. But this successful appeal colt, who happens to be a May foal. So, I mean, this horse, you know, still at least 6 weeks away from even being a full 2-year-old. Hancock gets his first win of the meet, and Alec and Arthur for Hat Creek zips. This is a sight spread from Brookdale out of a De Jure mare, and Alec and Arthur zips. Went off a second choice, the 4-5 favorite. Champagne Affair kind of chased the pace for a little bit and then fell back. That was a daredevil filly for Windstar and the stablemates group. But Alec and Arthur, 580 with the Jimenez. So that got the 2-year-olds going, and certainly got to congratulate our friends Louis Lazanero and wife Stephanie. What a good spot Louis found Stephanie on Fleek, the Fleek horses that was first popularized by Louis naming Bobby on Fleek. That was an early winner. Couldn't really stay sound, but Bobby on Fleek giving way to Stephanie on Fleek, and a very nice performance. Pretty much, almost an as. You know, as pleasing kind of an effort, and the Orb Philly for Pletcher, and the Lazaneros, a winner and a starter allowance yesterday, and so now back to back wins, one at Gulfstream, and came back in a starter because she was eligible after running in a 50, in a maiden 50 at Gulfstream in January. So very cleverly spotted for the Lazanero. So congratulations. I texted Louie, and Stephanie was a tither today at Keeneland, and tomorrow two more good days of racing. And yesterday it was a good card, and today I actually, when I went through it, I was pretty much engaged and went ahead and wrote it up and handicapped it. Feels like there's a couple of horses in the sequence in the pick four today that are real potential leans, including Chad with Exalt in the nightcap. And it's a good group, but Exalt 8-5 and feels like he's got just a slight edge. Because if it's not going to be Chad that wins this, it could be another 5 or 6. Talk Verve to me comes back. Speaking of Rudy Brissett, comes back in the featured third level allowance. And again, not a big field, but you've got Talk Verve to me returning. Julien Leparoux draws the rail. And while Talk Verve to me certainly feels like the right, you know, feels like the, you know, the overwhelmingly likely winner, you do have Awestruck for Rusty Arnold, who, you know, can strike at any time, particularly at Keeneland. Awestruck in this spot. And Buff Bradley happens to have Upset Brewing, who is a, you know, is a filly that's been in my stable mail from early on. I think from when she first started her career, and remember talking to Buff. And so I get the entry notes on Upset Brewing. And she's not impossible in here. Everyone loves Jimmy for Ian Wilkes. And Chris Landeros puts on Blinkers and Treble for Moquette. So if we see Moquette later, we're going to find out what he thinks about Treble. But when it came to building the Pick 4 ticket, I only used Talk Viv and Awestruck. The first race in the pick four. John Ortiz has got a horse on the rail, We Need to Talk, who really seems poised for a good effort. And this is a first-level allowance going six. And after that, you know, there's three players, Seguro Row for Stidham and East Moon for Rusty with a Rat Ortiz and Shackleford County for Dale Romans. But We Need to Talk feels like a really strong lean to me. And 7-2, if she goes off as third choice, you're gonna have value. And so this is what appealed to me about this sequence. There felt like some pretty logical types. And then there's an excellent turf allowance as the seventh. And this is a squirrely race. There's a field of 12, and there's a couple of horses, including Chad Brown with Connectivity, your 3-1 morning line favorite. But this group is not separated by two lengths, the top contenders. And there's even a contender, Michael Ewing, sends out Chanel Princess. Chanel Princess, 30-1. And that's a silly price, because Chanel Princess is no 30-1 shot compared to about the next six or seven horses in here. So the seventh is the place where you're going to have to figure out how many you're going to use, because if it's not connectivity, Fortunate Girl from the rail for Cassie, I mean, there feels like there's pace in here. So I thought that the seventh is the place where you're going to spread a little bit, and then you can go narrow elsewhere to try to maybe even really press a little bit in this sequence. It's another really good day of racing. And tomorrow, of course, Friday, brings you the Makers 46, the mile with Heart to Heart and Kurban and Delta Prince, Raging Bull for Chad, and Great Wide Open, Connor Murphy, a nice group, Hembry for Maker, and Shug's got Dr. Mounty, and Tommy Bush rounds out the group with Clyde's Image. So eight of them in the grade one, Makers 46, a couple of good allowances. You got the turf sprint as well that starts to pick four, and there's a third level allowance where Coppertown returns for Pletcher, and Mr. Crow for Ben Colebrook, who used to be with Pletcher. That's a Korea, that's a KSA or the KRA runner, and Curate for Brad Cox. So a very good pick five sequence tomorrow at Keeneland. And there's also a good maiden race. Tomorrow's card, really outstanding at Keeneland again. So, as usual, the action at Keeneland, terrific. We've got to stay here, of course, we'll press through. I can't take a break this morning. So we'll walk right through the 3 hours with Joe on the board, and you'll bear with me a little bit as I give Jolene some of the numbers. Dick Powell's going to join us, and we'll have Dick give us some of the results. You know, they're getting ready for the big action at Hong Kong, and there you go, Joe. That's for you. I'll send that to Jolene. We'll talk to Dick about the weekend, and was curious what he's got for us as well. Later, Tony Black, of course. Speaking of Tony Black and the jocks, after we got off the air, had a fun conversation, kind of a rollicking conversation with Dan Ross. And Dan has been so busy in California, is doing terrific work, whether he's writing for ThoroughbredRacing.com or for TDN. And a couple of different stories. One was a feature that he wrote. You really should see in TDN, and we'll talk about it next week. He wrote a fascinating piece about surface analysis and surface comparisons. And that requires some attention. But Dan when I called him, actually he called me, a guy sent him a text with a question, and he let me know that the decision had been made that the jocks will ride with the crops on Friday, tomorrow. They're not going to go ahead with the no crop Friday, the no whip Friday, as it was being called. So that was tabled for now. At some point it'll certainly get. I think it's going to get. You know, it's opportunity, but I want to talk to Tony a little bit more about that topic. But anyway, Dan let me know, and I appreciate it. We'll get more about the whip situation when we talk to Tony Black. Let's say hello to Dick Powell. Dick, good morning.
Dave, good morning. Where's my intro music?
well, Joanne is working the board. Casey
know,
back in the hospital.
Is.
Yeah.
I heard. God, man.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, hopefully he's out and can join the fight again.
Yeah, he's going to, apparently, in fact, they just heard from him. He's going to be there, looks like, through Sunday. So it's got to be so tough. Well, listen, you went through a health crisis yourself. You know what that score is.
You know, I shouldn't say comical, but the comical thing with me is I'm surrounded by people whose health issues are far more serious than mine. So I don't take mine as seriously as you would think. It's okay. My wife has some. Let me give you a quick plug to my wife. My wife has had 11 abdominal surgeries.
Oh my gosh.
All at Mount Sinai in Manhattan, because the surgery she's had is not performed anymore. So there's this one surgeon that still does it, and he's the expert. This past Sunday, she finished first in her training level 3 dressage test against open professional riders. Down in Venice, Florida.
Oh, that's
He's
tremendous.
65 years old. You talk about dedication and all that, and overcoming and all that. And if you talk to her, there's nothing self-serving about my wife. She's kind of goal-oriented, and I call her hard-headed. She's like focused on, you know, her dressage is her passion, her grandchildren are her passion. But she spent most of the winter in Florida to get out of the cold and ship the horse down there. And she has this beautiful 17-hand gelding that's just incredible. And she's tall, so she fits them real well. And she wound up winning on Sunday with a score of 70. When you get into 70, you're getting pretty high up there. And beat open professional riders. She's an adult amateur. But she gets a blue ribbon. You know, that's nice. we don't get first check.
That's all right.
We got them all over the house.
I love it. So, that's really nice to congratulate her. That's wonderful.
And she's so psyched up about it that, you know, I once hit a pick six for a good amount. And what thrilled me was I knew the money wasn't going to stay in my hands very long. But just doing it, you know, just achieving it was yep. all to me, all important. So she's done well before, but this one. This is a younger horse that she's developed, and and she puts the work in. She does have a trainer, but she's the one riding. She's the one putting all the work in and stuff like that. So it's very good. So yes, if you have physical issues and stuff, it shouldn't be stop what you enjoy.
Yeah, no, that's a winning anecdote, and. I'm glad it came up. I appreciate you telling us. Give us Dick. We can do a couple of things, and I don't know how much of the California action you heard while we were out there, but the fallout, including the story I just referenced. That Dan Ross wrote in TDN, that's in TDN's today. He wrote an extensive piece about It's titled Synthetics and Sealed Dirt, The Science, Data, and Expert Opinion, which I really urge people to read. Dan Ross, who's an exercise rider himself, rides in the mornings at Santa Anita and rides for Drysdale and in a lot of top outfits. He's done really terrific work and has, kind of quietly, been doing it for a couple of years, and has kind of been, more high profile and featured, I think, in a wider, on a wider basis. And he's been on the show, but everything he looks at, he comes at from all the different angles, and considering all the multifactorial issues involved in a situation like we had at Santa Anita and like we had in New York and Del Mar went through, being able to examine every factor, goes a long way. So I don't know if you've read this yet, but, I know that
I did.
Yeah. Well, Surface, you famously, you and Corns, Jim Corns, you guys... tracking the way the Saratoga in particular would be groomed, and I always got a kick out of the way you would keep track of how the supers, of course now Glenn Kozak for an extended period, but before that you had to deal with Pissarro, who was constantly tinkering and monkeying with the track, and you guys. This is a topic that I've even referenced you, Dick, to some people. The story you told me at the HPPA when we had breakfast, that you had noted over the years sealed tracks and the after effects within 24 to 48 hours and what their negative impact have been over the years, and I think the time's right for you to deliver that same discussion.
Do I get a free breakfast out of it?
Yeah, absolutely. We'll give you
9:30. Steve, I'm getting hungry. You had to mention breakfast. Just anecdotally and observationally, Ruffian broke down on a Sunday. Friday, the last race at Belmont had to be canceled because a thunderstorm hit them, basically blacked out, washed out the track. And years ago, and the few old-timers out there might remember this, the only way you could watch replays was to go to the track early the next day and watch yesterday's replays at 11:30 in the morning. So I'm out there on Saturday, because Forgo was running on Saturday in the Suburban. And they show the replays, and they get to the ninth race, and it's just like this black cloud, and there's no ninth race on Friday. So Saturday, sealed rock hard track, Forgo, bad ankles and all, runs a mile and a quarter and 59 and 4. That's out of the old chute that no longer exists, that used to start on the training track. So track obviously very fast, very hard. Next day she breaks down. Go for one in 1990. That Tuesday, there was 6 inches of rain, late October, and then crazy wind. So instead of harrowing the track, and when these guys say they harrow the track, they scratch the top of the track. They're not really harrowing the track. So that track had like a shelf on it, that it was dry on the top, but underneath that crust, you don't know what's going on. And not only did Gopalan catastrophically get hurt, but lots of other horses got hurt that day as well. That was extremely unsafe track. And then there's others, but the Eight Bells incident was Kentucky Derby on a Saturday, and that Friday there was pouring rain at Churchill. One horse went down but survived, and the next day it's dried out, and I don't necessarily have a problem with sealing the track, because if you have a dirt track, you have to save the track. You can't let some horrible thunderstorm come in and wash the track away, because that's even more dangerous, and you're going to be closed for a couple of days while you're trying to, resurface it. I don't have a problem with that. My problem is when the track dries out, that it doesn't dry out uniformly. To think that's true is just false. And we need to turn the track over. Or, this sounds crazy, water it. Because if you watered it, you would maintain some of the consistency that it had before. Now, well, Dick, why would you water a track that's listed as good or something like that? But to me, the most dangerous track, and these anecdotes show it, and there are others, but the most dangerous track is a sealed track with lots of rain, so lots of composition to hold, that's then drying out real fast and doesn't get harrowed deep enough. That creates all sorts of uncertainties in the racetrack. I've talked to people about it. I talked to the Interior Safety Alliance about 10 years ago about it, that maybe as a protocol that you harrow deeper, you have heavier, deeper harrows to get more into the more down to the bottom of the base and make sure everything's getting turned over and becomes more uniform. And I still don't see anybody doing it.
Have you gone to the track superintendent's sessions?
No.
Tony's next, and Tony goes every year. And when you told me that, and I've relayed that, you know, what you just went through, I've relayed that to, I don't know, three or four people since, and that was just maybe 6 weeks ago, give or take. And yeah. It can't be coincidental. It just makes too much sense. And this is, I know that the synthetic conversation is already bubbling to the surface. And the key element to that is going to be how much advancement there's been. It came up the other day, and I think the conclusion was, there's really only domestically, right? There's just Tapita. There's just the Michael Dickinson product.
Yes, Golden Gate, Presque Isle, Woodburn.
Yeah. So.
And the others did a bad job. I mean, Polytrack was installed. Horseman in San Diego, Del Mar had complaints. And the answer was, well, we'll wait till the end of the meeting. Come out and look at it. Well, that's not good enough. And Keeneland had some issues, and they weren't necessarily addressed. And they're not perfect. I've never said they were perfect. As a better, the first Pacific Classic with Polytrack had 14 horses, and they went 207 for a mile and a quarter.
Yeah.
They all came back safe. I'm in favor. I'm a handicapper. I can adjust to 207 mile and a quarter. No big deal.
Well,
there were certain people in this industry, Steve, that hated synthetic tracks because they never got the fact that you're handicapping a hybrid surface. They tried to handicap it like it was a dirt surface. And the biggest misnomer, and I've made money on this, is with synthetic tracks, speed holds up to about 6.5 furlongs, sometimes 7. Then anything going 2 turns, speed doesn't hold up as well. Well, one reason is the jocks ride it as if it were a turf race. So when you see 2-turn races, you don't usually get any kind of pace like you would get at the old Santa Anita, not today's Santa Anita, the old Santa Anita, where they're going 23.46, going 2 turns. You just don't get that on synthetic. So on paper, it doesn't look like speed's holding up. And it's probably true. But there's an energy return on racing surfaces. And when Keeneland first put in Polytrack, they ran 4.5 furlongs in, what was it, 48 and 4, Wesley Ward. I don't know if it was Runaway and Hyde. Or he had a couple of horses break 50 seconds for 4.5 furlongs because the energy return is that good. Now as you go farther, the energy return lessens. And okay, so as handicappers, we were told immediately, oh, this is bad, this is bad, this is bad. And the public says, oh, I don't bet plastic, I don't bet this, I don't. Well, I made my biggest scores in history at Hollywood Park just following that track and picking up nuances and things like that. To me, they're consistent, they're predictable, and they are not as weather affected as dirt tracks are, but they're not as racetrack superintendent affected. as dirt tracks go. Because dirt tracks, you know, we keep reading about dirt tracks as if there's this, you know, monolith of dirt tracks. And I've never seen two dirt tracks the same. And then, and in a given day, you could sit there at Saratoga for 11 races, and you're looking at a dirt track that is dramatically different from early in the day, late in the day, how they're grooming it,
sure,
how they're watering it. It was, what was the year with, it was a couple years ago with Gunrunner. And I know Steve was real worried about that track, as were many people. And Gunrunner won the Whitney, and the horses came back soaking wet because they had just drenched that track. Because when I came back up to the paddock to my seats, I'm like, did I miss the thunderstorm? some rain event happened when I was coming up the escalator. And rightfully so, they watered that track really good. But then that's hard for handicappers to keep track of as to how the track is being groomed and maintained throughout the day. So to think that dirt gives you this consistent surface, I don't know. I'm not as obsessive as Jim is, because he gets a little bit out there. But you learn to pay attention to what's going on. You're sitting in a track that's 30 minutes between races. You know, you do have the opportunity to watch the harrows and whatever's going on, and then see how the track is playing and compare it to how the track is being groomed.
Well, when you mention the displeasure and the, you know, the negative reaction at the time, and I think part of it was the way proponents had advertised the benefits. Oh, it's maintenance free. It's so easy to take care of. Oh, there were all these promises about what it could do, what Polytrack was going to do, and then that was even before we knew there were five or six other brands between the Pro Ride and the Cushion Track, I don't know if Fiber Sand ever even was looked at in North America, but anyway, when racetracks started to having to deal with it, and then of course dealing with the atmospheric conditions, the heat, the humidity, the sun, Del Mar was probably the most extreme with the cool mornings and then the hot afternoons, and the track went from tight and nice and fast to torpid and sticky and gummy. I mean, it's not a set of conditions that the horsemen, you know, can appreciate, or, you know, it was confusing to everybody. I mean, there'd be workout times from Del Mar that were normal, felt like normal workout times. Then the horses would go and run, and it was, you know, it was slow. And then, of course, the jocks tried to adjust to the way the track played. And so everybody was kind of holding and holding and holding their horses. It was trying to make the last run. So the experiment, as it were, and it's not fair to call it a failed experiment or an era that didn't, you know, that wasn't successful. I mean, the fact that we have, you know, we have some major racetracks that are still, you know, that are still using synthetic. So a revisit of this is certainly going to take place. I mean, as part of what's transpired here.
Well, when Jim was working in Dubai, which he did for many years with Kieran McLaughlin and then with the Dubai Racing Club, he called me once when they put in Tapeta at Maydan, that Natalshiba had dirt. Now they're going to Tapeta. Now, Alcoa's training, where Saeed Ben Sarur is, that had Tapeta all along. That was one of the first Tapeta installations. But everyone else didn't have it and they were going to have like a horseman's meeting. So Jim calls me and says, what are some of the points? I said, well, here's what I've just observed. And you just touched on it. At Del Mar, because of the changes in the morning, it's cool, it's moist. The sun hasn't evaporated all the moisture out of the track and everything else. That the horses are working fast. Therefore, they confuse you. You think you have a fit horse. You run them in the afternoon, you don't have a fit horse. And what you used to see, you still see it at Turfway and synthetic tracks, is when a horse gets tired, they're kind of all over the place because their footing, the footing is so good that when they start tiring or get hit left-handed, they might jump two pets to the other direction than one pet. So you see a lot of veering in and out. And you would see races at Del Mar where horses clearly weren't fit for the race. So my advice was, when you think you have a horse that's fit based on morning training, take another 2 weeks. That they're fooling you by the times in the morning and how effortlessly they're working in the morning, because they're not going to get those circumstances in the afternoon. And I think that was one of the big complaints, that no one really supported the synthetic tracks. I mean, with Tapita, you know, what I've written in the past was, if you put in Tapita, you're getting Michael Dickinson. Even if you don't want Michael to show up, Michael's going to show up, go out, walk on the track, do whatever he has to do. And that's the kind of customer service that him and his team provide. And the others really didn't do that. They were mostly British international-type products that put them in and, as you said, oversold them, and then didn't quite support them or didn't really provide an educational background that, you know, your horse has to get a little more fitter to race under the afternoon conditions that you're not getting in the morning, especially at Del Mar, where the difference between the morning and the afternoon is almost 100% predictable. You know, it's like that every day. And therefore, as a handicapper, I enjoy that. I think it's one less thing I have to keep track of and stuff like that. But, yeah, there were those issues that were oversold. And when some of the bettors turned on them, even though when most tracks put in synthetic, betting went up. And the famous race at Keeneland was, they had a 12-horse turf race with one main track only, and the race came off the turf, and all 13 ran. So I don't think we've ever had that since then.
Exactly.
We come off the turf, and we got more horses than we had going in. So it's just, I'm glad, and I'm not glad about the circumstances, but I'm glad that it's still being discussed and still out there as a possibility of improving horse safety.
Well, and then the other topic that it has to get folded in, that is probably going to be viewed differently now than it was then. I mean, even though the safety aspect was paramount, and that is the different kind of physical issues that the synthetic, that horses were more susceptible to on synthetic, and that was hind end. And I'm sure if I went back and dug through, you know, all the conversations with Dr. Allday, and he's famously a hind end specialist, and, you know, pioneered treatments for particularly hind end strains. The synthetic, the knock on the synthetic, or the complaint about the physical properties, was that horses were more susceptible to soft tissue injuries than they were to breakdown type scenarios of, you know, of horses presenting non-clinically, you know, no apparent fissures and the kinds of things that lead to horses, you know, breaking down, basically. So under the scrutiny and the pressure about specifically horses breaking down, you know, that's the positive, that it's a alternative that absolutely lowers incidence of catastrophic breakdown, unseen by the public. I mean, and they see the breakdowns, but unseen is the soft tissue injuries and horses' careers potentially being shortened by that, because bowed tendons and so forth are going to end careers. And not only end careers, I mean, it also even would limit a horse's potential for second careers. So this is the complexity. And what, you know, Dick, what's frustrating about everything that's gone on out of the last, whatever, 3, 4, 5 weeks is that the public, you know, the general public that might be decrying, the 23 horses. None of this is going to be discussed with them. There's going to be snap judgments. There's no depth of discussion, and it makes it very hard on the industry. I mean, nobody's going to take the time to understand these issues. And we can talk about how, as an industry, we need to communicate better and so forth, but. This is ultimate inside baseball when it comes to, you know, horse well-being and the care and maintenance of the modern racehorse.
Yeah, and the thing that really has bummed me out is who's fighting for horse racing. I mean, we have an industry that relies on the testosterone of a stallion and the hormone level of the mare and them getting together and having a foal that eventually becomes a racehorse. Well, where is the testosterone in this industry? I don't see it. We gotta grow a pair. I mean, just who's out there other than defending their positions and defending their fiefdoms and everything else, who's out there fighting for horses? And I just don't see it. Or if I see it, it's pretty ineffective. So when you have a crisis, well, now I'm seeing, gee, those people, they haven't even come out of the foxhole. Forget about, stick their head up and see what's going on. And I think it's exposed a lot of things that are possibilities to fix, but also exposing, you know, the weakness of our alphabet soup organizations that defend their position, defend themselves from attacks from other alphabet soup organizations, but no real big picture. But then when you get the protesters, that kind of like gets a little focus because, yeah, they have an agenda. They want to, many of them want to end horse racing. So we got, this is really exposed a lot of problems, and if it weren't 23, and let's say it was 16, well, is 16 acceptable? Is 16 the best you could do in that time period and stuff? And that's where they got us, because I saw the, where did I see it? I saw it this morning somewhere, pictures of the protesters from Saturday and the signs they had, and one woman had, you know, each year and how many horses that have died in racing and training. I assume throughout California, not just Santa Anita. So, yeah, the numbers kind of vary and everything, but in total, it's like, wow, average person sees that. Why do we have horse racing? Look at all these horses that are dying.
Well, why do we... There's also the disconnect. There's the whole question, or not question, but the whole reality of these are animals that we as an industry that we're partnered with, and there's going to be, you know, there's going to be a certain amount of loss, it's hard to understand how people don't fathom that it's contributing to the livelihood and the, you know, the lives of countless people. It's a business. It's an industry. And I don't know why. You can talk about the changing mores and so forth, but it can. We don't have to defend ourselves, other than to say, you know, we do the best we can to limit the amount of horses that die. But people's lives, this is, the people are have lives that are tied to this. And I don't see the cattle industry and the poultry industry, or you know, any other that utilizes livestock and has a partnership with the care and maintenance of animals, I don't get it. I don't I'd like, that's why Nick Luck's statement.